This is Radio Equalshock with your host, Alex Smith.
In the Arctic darkness of February 2018, there was an extreme heat event at the North Pole. The temperature was over 30 degrees Fahrenheit, over 17 degrees C above normal. That is part of the amplified Arctic warming that crashed the summer sea ice and started the great melt of polar glaciers. It changes everything. New science is struggling to explain why it is happening in the Arctic. Researchers from China, the U.S., and Australia worked on a breakthrough paper published last November in the journal Nature Climate Change. Here to explain the surprising findings is the lead author, Dr. Malte Stucker. In a way, Malte is representative of the global nature of climate science these days. After an education in Germany, he got his Ph.D. at the University of Hawaii. Following a position as a NOAA Climate and Global Change postdoc fellow, he's now a research professor at the IBS Center for Climate Physics at Pusan National University, Republic of Korea. From Pusan, Korea, Malte Stucker, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you very much for the nice introduction.
Well, you have published papers on the Pacific Ocean and rice in the Philippines, but how did you get drawn into the problem of why the Arctic has become so wildly warm?
Most of my PhD work was actually focused more on the tropics, but when I moved to the University of Washington for my postdoctoral research, I worked together with a lot of polar scientists, and I got really excited about learning more about what's happening in the high latitudes, and that was when this project that we published last November was started.
It was shocking when the summer sea ice crashed in 2007, and now Siberian ports are gearing up for commercial traffic. How strange is it when the whole Arctic changes within a couple of decades?
It is certainly one of the big issues we face in a changing climate. And we've known for long that the Arctic will be one of the regions that will warm fastest in response to increasing greenhouse gases. In a way, it is a situation that's been long in the coming, but the detailed processes, what are most important for these changes in the Arctic, they've been debated for a long time, and our recent paper has helped us to understand a little better the driving forces behind these changes.
Well, yes, before we get to the conclusions of your study, there were several competing theories of why warming in the Arctic is so much greater than in the rest of the world. What was the strongest contender, would you say, before your team's paper came out?
There's many different processes that have been proposed for this amplified warming, and it depends a little bit about what we are talking about. There are certainly changes in the Arctic that are due to internal variability, and due to internal variability in the tropics that might influence how heat is transported into the Arctic. But then there are also local processes that have to do with changes in the sea ice, so once we have melt and sea ice, we can absorb more incoming radiation, so that would, because less is reflected back to space, which was hypothesized as a driving force. So there's been all these ideas around, and they certainly all play a role, but we wanted to really quantify what is most important.
I thought it was mainly ocean waters coming up from the tropics. We've seen heat maps that show hotter waters going from the Gulf Stream into the Arctic and also through the Bering Strait via Alaska. Are you fairly confident that you've ruled out oceans as the agent transferring tropical heat to the Arctic as this primary cause of amplification?
Changes in ocean currents can certainly influence local changes in temperature and sea ice, but it's not really, when we talk about the influences from the tropics that's been discussed previously, it's not so much the ocean current that we would discuss, but the fact that if the tropics warm, we change really the global circulation of the atmosphere, and you have transport of heat via the atmosphere into the Arctic region, which is a much more efficient process than changes in the ocean current, which are much usually occurring on much slower timescales.
Well, that makes sense. So as I understand it, for the purpose of this study, your team produced a model that quadruples pre-industrial carbon dioxide. And when you run this experiment with much higher CO2, which may very well happen all too soon, what did you conclude is the main driver of Arctic amplification?
So, as you mentioned, we approach this problem by trying to really isolate the role of local radiative forcing that's coming from changes in the CO2 concentrations. And we noticed when we put increased CO2 concentrations just in the tropics, which is an idealized experiment, we didn't see much of a response in the Arctic region. So when we increase the CO2 concentrations in the subtropics and mid-latitudes, we see some pronounced warming in the Arctic that's coming from heat transport from the mid-latitudes into the Arctic. However, this warming is pretty uniform globally, and there's not this pronounced amplified warming in the Arctic. That means that the Arctic is warming much more than the rest of the globe. So we only get this amplified signal when we prescribe the CO2 concentrations locally in the Arctic, which really points that local processes in the Arctic are the main driving force. And there are several candidates then that we looked at, and we isolated which of these are most important. So we found that there's this process called the lapse rate feedback, which has to do with the vertical structure of the atmosphere, that's most important. But then there's other factors, for example, like the sea ice feedback, the albedo feedback, and changes in cloud that also play a role. But these are of secondary importance.
So is the atmosphere in some way creating a kind of lid that's keeping the heat in the Arctic, and that's something that doesn't happen further south?
So, yeah, that's exactly the case. So it's very interesting if you compare the tropics, the tropical atmosphere with the Arctic atmosphere, they're very different. They're very different systems. So in the tropics, we really have these deep clouds, the thunderstorm clouds that go all the way from the surface into the upper troposphere, and they're very effective at bringing heat and moisture from the lower atmosphere all the way up. So what happens is that when you have increasing CO2 concentrations in the tropics, a lot of the warming is actually happening in the upper atmosphere, not in the lower atmosphere. And because it's happening in the upper atmosphere, it can actually, a lot of that energy can radiate back out into space. But if you compare that with the Arctic region, in the Arctic region, we have something what we call a very strong inversion. What that means is that we have this strong lid on the atmosphere, and air that's at the surface hardly can move up because it's very stable. So what then happens if you warm the Arctic is that that heat is really trapped near the surface, and it still tries to radiate out some of this energy into space, but because it's radiating out from the surface and not the upper atmosphere, much less efficient in doing so. And that process is something what we call this lapse rate feedback.
Well, I have to admit, at first I was a bit confused by the paper. I kind of wandered away from the real point of it, but I was wondering, where does this local carbon dioxide come from? And I know that wasn't really what you were talking about, but there are not many sources in the Arctic other than a few Russian cities and maybe aircraft flyovers. Does it matter where the carbon dioxide comes from, or do we know where it comes from?
Yeah, it can be a bit confusing. I should motivate this paper a little bit better. So, of course, CO2 concentrations in reality are well mixed throughout the atmosphere due to the storms that circle around the Earth. Usually they mix up all the gases in the atmosphere, so we have very similar concentrations across the globe. So even though you have some sources, maybe in industrialized regions where you emit more CO2, it's going to be well mixed within the atmosphere within a couple of months to a year. In our case, we just wanted to understand actually the dynamics of the coupled system, and to that we usually have to do more idealized situations. Because in the real world, if we increase in the climate model CO2 everywhere, we see that the Arctic is warming more, but we don't know what is the driving process. So by kind of separating it out from regional changes, we can understand the actual dynamics of the coupled system a bit better. But that's not to say that this is a realistic case. But we have confidence that the mechanisms that we find actually apply to nature, because if we look at the response in these climate models to a global increase in CO2 concentrations, first of all, it looks very similar to what we see happening in nature. So nature is actually showing this Arctic amplification, what the models predict. So this gives us confidence that the models have skill and we can trust them. And then next is if we separate out experiments with increasing the greenhouse gases just in certain regions, and we look at the individual responses to these experiments and add them all up, actually the results look the same as the response to the global forcing. So this allows us to decompose these local changes into local processes, which is a very powerful way of understanding the climate system better.
Some Russian scientists and others in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group say methane from the seabed and from thawing permafrost under millions of Arctic ponds are contributing to Arctic heating. Did your study consider the influence of methane?
No. In our study, we only looked at one greenhouse gas, that is CO2. In reality, we have additional players like methane, as you mentioned, that are very important. But the net effect is similar. So both CO2 and methane will trap more heat in the atmosphere and contribute to a warming of the planet. Do the simulation, if we would do the simulation instead with increasing methane, it would give qualitatively the same results, but only the difference would be that methane is an even stronger greenhouse gas, so you would expect an even stronger response. So that's why we should be worried about methane emissions, because the greenhouse gas potential of this gas is even stronger than of CO2.
Based on the processes that you've looked at in this study, do you think the Arctic will continue to warm more than the rest of the world, or is there some kind of limit that it might reach and stabilize?
We are pretty confident. Like, every individual model shows that the Arctic will continue warming stronger than the rest of the planet. All the models will show that Arctic sea ice is increasing at rapid rates. So that's regrettably a future that we are facing unless we reduce emissions. However, on top of this, there's certainly also internal variability of the climate system that can give you certain years where ice would maybe increase again before it drops. So we don't expect these changes that every year is going to be another record hot year. But if you look at changes over 5 years or 10 years, we will certainly see an acceleration of the warming. And that's something the models are very consistent, and we are very confident it will happen unless there are big changes in our emissions.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from South Korea. Our guest is the research scientist Dr. Malte Stucker. He is the lead author of a new study explaining why the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the world. Will these study results help us understand how fast Greenland ice could melt?
Certainly, for things like the ice sheets, what's really important is how many days in the summer we stay over the melting temperature. And this accumulated effect of these warm summer days will be one of the major driving forces of melt. So we can certainly use experiments like the one we did to quantify these processes. However, we haven't looked at the specific problem in our experiment yet.
There is a secondary result from your paper which could be controversial. The paper says, quote, "Thus, reducing radiative forcing at the pole may be a more effective policy to minimize Arctic amplification than previously thought." Now, I could read that as saying that solar radiation management, like spraying sulfate aerosols in the Arctic, might be effective because of the local nature of the problem. Is that fair?
That is certainly correct. So if humans decide that they want to go ahead with radiation management, which in my personal opinion think should only be a last resort, because it's not an easy fix. The easier fix is changing our technology into a more carbon-efficient society. But in case humans should decide that they want to employ radiation management, then the question is, where would you put those aerosols to have the biggest net effect? And also, it depends on what you want to achieve. So are you concerned about the monsoon regions? Are you concerned about maybe weather in Europe or in Asia? So these are very complex questions that humans have to grapple with. But we just ask this very simple question without giving a political judgment, that in case you wanted to decrease the temperatures in the Arctic, then having radiation management by spraying aerosols in the Arctic region would be an effective way of decreasing the effect of global warming there, of local warming there. But yeah, that is not said that it's a good idea to do so.
With this new study, Malte, are we now at the point of a confident solution to the problem of Arctic amplification, or is this still a matter for scientists and competing climate models?
So one thing I need to acknowledge is that we tested this mechanism just with one climate model. It's a very good model, but we certainly would like to get more confidence by having other groups using different models to do similar experiments to see if they can confirm our results. In general, though, we are pretty confident because all other climate models give this general pattern of pole amplification. So I think that our confidence is pretty strong. However, there are certainly more things to figure out, and one of those things are the importance of changes in ocean currents that you alluded to earlier. So as the globe warms, we have likely changes in ocean currents, and how much heat is transported into the Arctic or out of the Arctic will further determine how sea ice and temperatures will change. And that's something that might be more model-dependent and something that we need to look into in more detail. Especially, we might need to use higher-resolution models that really can resolve those narrow currents into the Arctic that are of importance here.
While we have you here, let's touch on a couple of previous papers you co-authored. For example, many of us are worried about the planet will not be able to feed billions of humans if Earth warms beyond the tolerance of some major food crops. And your August 2018 paper suggested rice may hit that ceiling during this century in the Philippines. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. This was a project I worked together with a biologist from the University of Hawaii and a fellow climate change scientist also at the University of Washington. And we got really interested in this nexus of water, climate, energy, and food. And there's been a lot of interest in the climate community to see how these changes that we are projecting to occur, how will it affect humans on these really fundamental levels. And one of the most fundamental levels is, of course, food security. And one of the crops that is most important worldwide is rice because it feeds most of Asia, where most of the global population lives. So just to tackle this a bit, to understand how climate variability actually can impact rice production, we decided to use the Philippines as a case study because it's nice that we have for the Philippines, we have very good rice production data for a couple of decades now. And the Philippines has a lot of different provinces, and we have this data actually on a province level, and we have it on a quarterly, it's reported quarterly. We could really go onto the very small province level and on the small temporal level and see how it relates to climate variability that's occurring in the Pacific. And there we found that your answer really depends a lot on in which province you are located. So that really pointed out to highlight that for local policymakers, they need much better information on how larger climate signals like El Nino really affect their local county or their local province to make informed decisions on how they plan for their rice production in the coming growing season.
And again, most climate science worries about positive feedbacks, the interactions that heat the planet even more. But you participated in a paper in Nature Climate Change that found a negative feedback. Why would a warming Atlantic Ocean lead to a cooling force in the Pacific?
Oh, it's maybe not really correct to say it's a negative feedback per se, because the mechanisms we looked at is more a cyclic phenomena that occurs on timescales of 20 years, but it can easily reverse. So it's not something that will have much impact in the long-term future in response to global warming. However, it can really be important on timescales that are also important for humans for the next 10 years if you want to make policy decisions. And what we found is that one of the reasons that the Earth over the last 20 years has warmed slightly less than our models projected was that the tropical Pacific was in an anomalous cold stage. So something that's been referred to as a negative phase of the interdecadal Pacific Oscillation, which just means there's enhanced upwelling of cold ocean water in that region. And in this study, we've actually found that one of the main reasons the Pacific was enormously cold was that the Atlantic, the tropical Atlantic Ocean, has warmed over this period enormously. So as I mentioned earlier, in the tropics, we can really propagate these signals throughout the atmosphere. So when you have a warming signal in the Atlantic, we heat the atmosphere, we have air moving up, and this changes the wind pattern throughout the globe, especially around the tropics. So what this warming in the Atlantic did, it created very different winds in the Pacific Ocean, which changed the structure of the upwelling of cold waters and increased the upwelling. At the same time, it actually led to enhanced sea level rise in the Western Pacific, so impacting a lot of people locally. However, this pattern will reverse as the Pacific will warm more, and also, of course, the ocean waters that will see more influence of the increased radiative forcing due to the increasing CO2 concentrations. So eventually, everything will warm up, but there can be periods of like 10, 20 years that have very distinct patterns that look different from a uniform warming around the globe.
Well, I think this is very important because, yes, things may even out later in the century, but we have to live through the next couple of decades. And I just spoke with Dr. David Victor about their paper saying global warming will happen faster than we think. And one of the factors that they mentioned was a natural warming that might occur in the next 10 to 20 years as part of a cycle, but that will reinforce other warming factors and could really affect everything from food to the rate of sea level rise to ice melting. So, yeah, we got to get through the short term before we get to the long term.
That is true. I completely agree. And there's a lot of effort, actually, within the climate community to try to make this initialized decadal predictions by putting the information we have of that, what's happening in the below the surface in the ocean, into climate models to make predictions how this will change the surface warming patterns over the next 10 years. However, this is a field that's still very in its early steps, and there's a lot of challenges to predict the climate system on these the regional patterns of the climate system on these like 10-year timescales. But it's something we should really pay a lot of attention to, because you're right, people live locally, and if sea level accelerates locally in one region, it has enormous impact on the local population. The same as if we have a enhanced warming in the Philippines, for example, this will affect rice production in this region enormously. And these things can have ripple effects due to the interconnected society that we live in. So it's not that just rice production affects only the people in that province, but it will affect global markets and it will have ripple effects throughout the world. And that's something we know for a long time, actually, in the climate community. We've been studying El Nino, these cyclic warming events in the Pacific, for a long time, and we see, even though it's a local phenomenon that's happening near the equator in the Pacific, we see global impacts in weather and climate, and we see global impacts in markets, we see global impacts in food production. So we have these case studies we can work on to try to understand these impacts of local patterns, but yeah, much more work has to be done to really inform regional policymakers.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. We have been talking with Dr. Malte Stucker, a research professor at the IBS Center for Climate Physics, Busan National University in the Republic of Korea. You can find links to the science we discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Malte, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
We're out of time, but we won't quit the climate fight. Join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.